Good afternoon. Welcome to the Commerce Committee. I'm going to call our meeting to order. There, it's working. Tuesday, March 3rd, 2020. We do have a quorum, and the first item of business is our approval of minutes.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative David moves approval of the minutes from February 26th. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The first bill on our agenda is from Representative Sock, House File 2967. Is he here? He is here. Sock? Dwayne? Yeah. Representative Sock, welcome to the committee. I will move your House File 2967 be re-referred to the Property and Local Tax Division. And I see you've got an author's amendment, a DE1 amendment.
I do, and I would like that put in because it essentially replaces the rest of the bill.
Excellent.
I think it's a delete all.
I will move the author's DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion to that motion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Sock, your bill is before us in your preferred format, and you may proceed with explaining the bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee. The circumstance that we have is trying to address the issue of affordable housing. We all know that that's just a big, great, big, ugly gorilla that we've been wrestling with for a long time. And one of the things that I think has passed us, it's very obvious to us, but it's not easily seen or recognized, and that is that the cost of a unit of housing in almost all of the conventional methods by which we did it, and when I was a broker, we did it, we sold houses, typically at about $250,000 a click. We put up apartment complexes at about $180 to $200 a click. And so as it goes through, the market is producing these housings, but they're all at price increments that are generally outside of the reach. And what I've done is endeavored to get involved with and put my energy into a place where I know that the starting increment of entry is something very modestly over $100,000 a click. And that is a big difference. So when you look at it, costs either around or above $200,000 per, and then this one drops it down to in the range of a bit over $100,000 per. That's a big difference to the market, and it's a big difference to the homeowners. For the benefit of those that know me, I've got prepared remarks here. I will endeavor to read them and not go on my own rambling. So, manufactured homes are titled as personal property, chattel, and reside on land that they do not own. Thus, traditional mortgage financing is not available to purchase the new houses. The amendment we're offering has been developed in conjunction with the State Bar Association and the Titling Association. Additionally, it's been reviewed by representatives from other financial industries, including credit unions, community banks, MFHA. We also added some language to address concerns of current park owners. New manufactured homes are built in the similar standards as stick-built houses, and there are four manufacturers in Minnesota. So we have actually local product here that are more than available in the state. Individuals who own a manufactured home and own the land under the home can obtain mortgage financing. MFHA has indicated that they have provided mortgage to that sort of property in the state of Minnesota commonly now. There are nine resident-owned cooperative communities in Minnesota with over 900 homes and 120 vacant lots. So there is space and availability for this to expand and be used. The legislation does not require any financial institution, including MFHA, to provide mortgage, but eliminates as a major obstacle the element of titling for the property as real property. If that becomes a challenge, I can give you the 30-minute speech that goes along with that. That's fair warning. Currently, condominiums and housing cooperatives are financed through traditional mortgage market products. We believe that legislation will create a market that will assist low-income working families to be able to purchase their mobile home products with mortgages. Both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are under orders to create this product. It should be coming into the market, as they say, soon. No idea for sure when that would be, but it is an intent that they have to produce that. So we have a lot of opportunity here that we can produce affordable housing for broad spectrum of Minnesota people. I'll leave it there. I've got with me
Sean McElhattan.
Thank you, Mr. McElhattan. You've introduced yourself for the committee, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean McElhattan, and I'm here representing North Country Cooperative Foundation, which is a Minnesota-based nonprofit organization that helps residents of manufactured home communities to organize, buy the communities, and operate the communities in which they live. Representative Salk has done a nice job in describing the place of manufactured housing in the state of Minnesota. Fully 25% of the market rate housing that's affordable to Minnesotans at or below 50% of area median income is in manufactured home communities. North Country Cooperative Foundation represents residents of 9 communities throughout the state of Minnesota, one of which is in Representative Haley's district. In those 9 communities, the median income is about $26,000-$27,000 a year. In every market in Minnesota, manufactured housing is the least expensive market rate housing. So when a manufactured housing community closes, and there have been an average of 300 units a year being lost over the last several years in Minnesota, often those people have no other place to go because there is no other option that's as affordable. So I just want to encourage support for this bill. As Representative Salk pointed out, it doesn't force anyone to do anything. This is the start. It's a necessary step to making this type of housing more affordable, more obtainable, but not sufficient. And we will need to work with lenders. We'll need to work with those government agencies to make product available, but we can't do it without passage of this bill. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing nobody, we can move to member discussion. Are there any questions from the members? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if this is to the representative of you, Mr. McInhack. So land trust. Houses are built on land. The land is owned by a different nonprofit agency oftentimes. The house is owned by the individual, and they're able to get a mortgage on the house. Is it because of the difficulty in moving a house off a piece of land versus the difficulty in moving a manufactured house off the land that is the determinant? Or does it have to do with the land isn't tied directly to the particular structure?
It's Mr. this McElhattan. Law, frankly. And because a manufactured home is chattel, so it's an automobile type title. That's the default under Minnesota law. If you own land and you bring a manufactured home on, there's a process that we're trying to amend that statute that says you can make that into real estate. But if you own the land collectively rather than individually, you can't do that. So what this law would do is to say if you own your home, if you own the land, either individually and collectively, and you own a home, it can become real estate. And then it functions just as a land trust does. I mean, that's exactly what it is.
Okay. Other questions from members? Representative Salk, you had a follow-up?
I was just also going to add, there's a number of, markets develop. People come to houses and they go to people that sell houses because they think that's the doorway. So oftentimes they are then tied to the issue of license. So in Minnesota, the license is to sell properties and land. So when I was a broker, I had no ability to sell a mobile home, except for that it was actually that it had released its title and was attached to the land, and then I can only sell the land. The mobile home becomes a fixture on that land or an improvement to the land. So we've got some strange places in law that we have driven the market to be a certain way. if we think back, oftentimes law is a product of history, the way we used to do things, the way we used to use things, and then now we are kind of saddled with those traditions. And this is an attempt to try to change the way the law is hindering people from actually just doing what they want to do. Because when I had a brokerage, people would come to our house and they'd have a picture and they'd have something and they'd have a for sale sign in the picture that showed this home that somebody was trying to sell. And they'd say, here, can you help me buy this? And no, we can't. Because as it turns out, that was a mobile home on somebody's private land. So it's the law is standing in the way of a lot of these things. I would offer to most of you that this is a first doorway that we have to get through in the process of modernizing the process of what how people can have home ownership on manufactured houses.
Thank you, Representative Sock. Any further questions, members? Seeing no further questions, I will renew my motion that House File 2967 be re-referred to the Committee on Property and Local Tax Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
As amended. As amended. Let me rephrase my motion. I renew my motion that House File 2967 be referred to the Property and Local Tax Division. Now we're going to get you on your way properly, sir. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oh, those opposed, no. The motion prevails and you are on your way.
Thank you, everybody, for your attention.
Next up on our agenda, we have Representative Katiza Watoon, House File 3369. I'm going to put on my reading glasses so I do this right. Welcome to the committee, Representative. You can proceed with moving your bill if you'd like.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move that House File 3369 be re-referred to Judiciary.
Representative Katiza Watoon moves House File 3369 be re-referred to Judiciary. I don't see any amendments in the packet.
Not this time.
Well, welcome, and you may explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 3369 is the Humane Pet Store Bill. This was brought to me from one of my constituents who is an animal lover and has worked on this issue personally and professionally. Eden Prairie is one of the 340 cities across the United States that have already established a citywide humane pet stores ordinance, and I'm proud of my community for leading on this topic. I'm also a rescue dog mom to a sweet Labradoodle who came home to us almost 7 years ago. You might have received a few emails on this topic from your constituents, from fellow Minnesotans, and a number of emails from out of
not
state.
Not from my constituents. I got them from everywhere else.
Representative in the country, yes. We're going to maintain order in our committee, and Representative Katiza, we're going to make sure that Representative Katiza Watoon has the floor.
Thank
duly
you,
noted,
Chair.
Representative. So, Representative Katiza Watoon.
As we can tell from just the sheer volume of emails that we've received, there's tremendous grassroots support for this bill and opposition to puppy mills in general. Approximately 95% of pet owners consider pets to be a part of the family and generally do not tolerate inhumane treatment of animals. But based on the content of some of these emails, it looks like there may have been some misinformation being spread, and I'm glad to be here today to, with my testifiers to clarify any confusion and take a significant step in the right direction for the animals and the people of Minnesota. So this bill seeks to end the pet store sale of dogs and cats from puppy and kitten mills by prohibiting the pet store sale of dogs and cats while allowing stores to co-host adoption events with shelters and rescues. House File 3369 adopts the humane pet store model that's being used widely already in the market. Most pet stores in Minnesota thrive without selling dogs and cats. In fact, there are fewer than 10 pet stores that still sell dogs and cats in the state of Minnesota and nearly 140 that do not. The bill is business friendly, and it's in alignment with the way that the market has already shifted toward this humane model. In fact, 24 of the 25 of the nation's largest pet store retailers do not sell puppies. They sell supplies and services. Example, PetSmart, Petco, Chuck and Don's, etc. And many of these stores opt to partner with rescues to offer space for them to adopt out animals. This builds new and loyal customer base and better community support. Stores can and have successfully transitioned from selling commercially bred cats and dogs to a humane model, and we will hear from one such store owner today. Minnesotans will continue to be able to purchase any breed of dog that they want directly from a breeder. The bill will not impact responsible breeders as they do not sell through pet stores. So it does basically three things. Defines pet shop as defined in the bill as a brick and mortar retail store. It says pet shops may not sell dogs and cats, and if they so choose, they are allowed to offer space to shelters and rescues for those entities to adopt out animals. And number three, it establishes a civil fine. So it's important to note that there is no requirement that the stores partner with shelters or rescues to, or that people in Minnesota will only be able to adopt rescued animals. Under this bill, people will always be able to seek out and buy a dog directly from a breeder, just like they always have. House File 3369 will promote humane pet stores, responsible breeding, and adoption while preserving consumers' right to obtain the dog of his or her choice. So at this point, Madam Chair, I would like to welcome my testifiers to the table and have them share their support.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Watoon. We have a number of testifiers on this bill, and we're going to just ask, I think everybody was notified that we're looking for 3 minutes at maximum testimony. And the first person on the list is Christine Coughlin, followed by Angel Duretti. I'll let you know when you're on deck so that you can be ready to come to the table. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Christine Coughlin, and I'm the Minnesota State Director with the Humane Society of the United States. I'm very pleased to be here today on behalf of our members and supporters and encourage your support for House File 3369. This is a bill that has tremendous widespread support from animal welfare organizations around the state of Minnesota. The Humane Society of the United States is the nation's largest animal protection organization. We're a national organization working for the protection of all animals. We're not affiliated with or an umbrella organization for local humane societies. Each one of them is their own independent entity. But we are the nation's largest provider of hands-on care for animals, over 100,000 animals every year. And even as we rescue so many animals, we know we cannot rescue our way out of all the problems that face animals. And it's important for us to get on the front end and try to prevent cruelty before it happens. This bill will end the pet store sale of dogs and cats from puppy and kitten mills while allowing stores to host adoption events with animal shelters and rescues if they choose to do so. Under this bill, Minnesotans will continue to be able to purchase any breed of dog they want directly from a breeder. The bill will not affect responsible breeders because responsible breeders do not sell to pet stores. We reviewed the code of ethics for the National Breed Clubs representing all 178 dog breeds recognized by the AKC and found that 96% of them had statements to the effect that their breeders should not and or do not sell to pet stores. Responsible breeders sell directly to consumers, and they welcome customers seeing where the puppies and breeding dogs live, which negates the need for a retail outlet. The market has responded overwhelmingly to the public's concerns about puppy mills and has moved towards a humane model. As mentioned, of the 25 largest retail pet stores in the country, 24 of them do not sell dogs and cats. In the humane model, big stores like Petco and PetSmart, as well as small independent shops, do not sell dogs and cats. They make money from selling supplies and services. Some of them do choose to partner with animal shelters and rescues to have adoption events, and these not only save the lives of homeless animals, but they bring new customers in the door. The puppy mill to pet store pipeline is well documented, and currently Minnesota pet stores that continue to sell dogs and cats can serve as a curtain behind which inhumane conditions remain unseen by the customer. But the humane model is the future, and it's right for Minnesota. Your vote in support of House File 3369 will protect consumers and animals while ensuring Minnesotans continue to have the right to get a pet of their choosing, whether adopted or from a responsible breeder. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Angel Duretti, and you can correct my pronunciation, and Steve Olson is on deck. Welcome to the committee. I look forward to you introducing yourself so we know how to pronounce your name correctly. My apologies.
Thank you for having me today. My name is Angel Duretti, owner of Angel's Pet World in Hudson is our first location in River Falls. We established our business in 2003. 2004, we decided to add puppies to our business. 2011, we decided to go humane. The reason for that is In those years, we used a large-scale Minnesota breeder, which most of the pet stores use. We got our vet involved, thought we were doing the right thing, until all the diseases, zoonotic, brucellosis, campylobacter, giardia, put my staff and myself at risk. Not only my staff and myself, the consumers, that maybe sometimes we didn't even know that they had these diseases until they were out of our care. Even though when we received the puppies, we took them right to the vet. At that time, they seemed healthy. You bring them back to the store, a week later, they break. So some of these diseases, brucellosis was probably our final draw, our final straw, as our vet said to us, have these puppies been around any females that are pregnant? That's how bad it is. It can kill the baby, cause miscarriage. So those are the diseases. How about 8-week-old puppy with hip dysplasia, luxating patellas that aren't covered, $2,000 surgeries when they've only had the puppy 2-3 weeks. So when we went humane, we were scared to death. Because, yes, was it a big stream of revenue coming in our store? What we didn't know were the tangibles is how many crates we were selling, how much dog food we were selling. Was this going to hurt our business? And even our accountant looked at us and said, are you taking a big risk? And we said, morally, we cannot do this to the consumer. And this isn't only us. I believe I'm speaking for any pet store that sells puppies. I went through it for 6 years. We've all used the same breeders. And I know what happens. I know that the consumer is calling me saying, now he has to have a patella surgery and it's not going to be covered. Mm-hmm. And this surgery is $3,000. So we decided to go humane. 1 month after we went humane, we knew we made the right decision. So we have doubled our staff. We have rescue organizations in every Saturday. We have them in Wednesdays and Thursdays. We have a cattery that we can house up to 15 cats through Dunn County Humane Society.
Go ahead. I know you're wrapping up. Thank you.
And we chose to do it that way. The amount of support we received was huge. The amount of people that come in and thank us to this day, and it's literally 9 years later, still come in and thank us for what we did. So I just know I've been there. I have documentation that it's not the right thing to either put the puppies through. It's not the right situation for puppies or kittens to live in. And it's not the right thing for the consumer, the end result. So
thank you for your testimony today. Steve Olson, followed by Dr. Lisa Roberts. I do not see Steve Olson. Dr. Roberts? Thank you. If Mr. Olson shows up, we can fit him in later. Okay. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Dr. Lisa Roberts. I am a veterinarian. I've been licensed in Minnesota for 15 years and Wisconsin for 2 years. My entire career has been focused on animal welfare. I started before vet school, even working at a local animal shelter in Wisconsin. And I've kind of stayed in the animal welfare world since graduating. So I've seen a lot and I've done a lot. I don't know how much some of my colleagues are going to talk about it, but I do want to mention that one of the main reasons that I want to support this bill today is what I call the widget kind of attitude towards animals that I just can't stand for it. Basically, when we have animals being produced in high numbers, as you see in puppy mills that do supply pet stores, they're being treated as cogs or products, and it's just not humane. It's just not okay in my mind at all. Again, we've mentioned in it, it's easy to see that consumers will still be able to get a purebred pug, beagle, dachshund, whatever they want, even the little mixed breed dogs that are popular now. You can still get that from a breeder, a well-run breeder, not a puppy mill dog that goes to pet stores. I've worked with good breeders, and what I know is that they get personally involved with each litter, with each pregnancy. They care, they get bonded to the puppies and kittens, and they find homes for each of them before they're even born oftentimes. People will have to be on a waiting list for a golden doodle from this breeder because there was only six, there were supposed to be seven. These dogs have good homes before they're born. They don't end up in shelters, and they don't end up in pet stores. These breeders don't sell to pet stores, so we're not trying to stop breeding of purebred dogs if it's done correctly. I know there are puppy mill bills out there, laws out there, but this bill will actually join and support and help at a different angle to stop that puppy mill industry to continue selling, and as somebody mentioned, using pet stores as a curtain to get these animals out of their property. My experience at the shelter and also in private practice has shown that that a lot of these dogs and cats that come from pet stores that were bred in mills have diseases, congenital diseases, cherry eye, jaw diseases, leg diseases, tracheal diseases. They're just not bred to high standards. They also have a lot of infectious diseases, including the upper respiratory viruses that are shared in dog-to-dog and cat-to-cat contact in poorly ventilated areas. Intestinal parasites galore. At the Animal Humane Society, when I worked there, we would take in cases from breeders that were shut down, and there was a 100% incidence of internal parasitism in every single adult dog that we got. That's completely not, that's not okay. Puppies are born with worms. Adult dogs should be dewormed. It's just not possible for a breeder to have a handful of staff who are usually untrained take care of hundreds to thousands of animals. Not only their medical needs, but behavior and mental needs as well. A lot of these dogs are shell-shocked. They don't end up making good pets. They're not socialized. It's just a bad situation all around. The other thing to consider is the public health impact. When these animals come in, as they do through pet stores with parasites, as was mentioned, well, I'm being told to stop.
You can wrap up okay. Conversations and, or yeah.
There are zoonotic diseases that can be really, really bad. Brucellosis was mentioned. That's a huge one. That's a reportable disease in Minnesota. That means that if a vet sees it, they have to go to the state board and say, hey, this disease is out there. It's horrible. Toxocara canis is a common parasite you'll see in the stool of puppies and kittens. That can cause roundworm lesions in the brain and eyes of children and elderly. So think about this. Somebody buys a puppy from a pet store, gives it to their child for Christmas. That child gets licked in the face by a puppy, ends up with a disease that it has to lose its eye. That's not okay. You see ringworm, which is a fungal disease, is also transmissible to human beings. Respiratory viruses that are passed dog to dog, including influenza and potentially novel respiratory viruses that we're seeing outbreaks of now across the world. We need to be careful about our public health. When we look at the way animals are raised and how closely they live with human beings, we need to make sure that they are healthy before just sending them out to the consumer. I think I only get rescue animals, but I think most consumers, even if they wanted to purchase a purebred dog, would prefer that it didn't have major congenital, behavioral, or health issues when they purchase it. So I thank you for your time, and I would love to urge you guys to listen to the animal experts that are going to be talking about this rather than those that are involved financially with continuing to sell to puppy stores and kitten stores, pet stores. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Next up, Dr. Graham Brayshaw, followed by Ann Olson. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Graham Brayshaw. I am the head vet at Animal Humane Society. We are, as was referred to earlier, the large local shelter. We deal with about 23,000 animals every year, and then our clinic deals with another about 12,000 animals every year in need in the local communities. What I wanted to speak to is, I timed it about a minute, so hopefully I'll be quick enough for everyone today. It's basically that pet stores are really supplied from puppy mills, and animals we've seen come from puppy mills are suffering. And if we can stop pet stores from selling these puppies, then we can get in front of really and reduce animal suffering. I've seen, usually it's one or two cases a year from what are considered puppy mills, and there is a typical look they do have coming in. They have a decreased muscle mass, often from decreased activity level, not getting as much exercise and enrichment. There is the teeth, and if any of you have dogs, cats with dental disease, the teeth of a 12, 13-year-old small poodle that is rather disgusting in a 3, 4-year-old animal. They have really advanced disease. And as Dr. Lisa spoke to, there's definitely a social demeanor that is atypical from any typical dog or cat we've got. They're not properly socialized. And there are breeders that do an excellent job. There really are great breeders out there, and that's not where the aim of this is whatsoever. But it really is trying to look at animals that are out there that are suffering and try and reduce that suffering. So the reason I'm up here, I want to speak in support of this bill, because the sale of animals through these pet stores really does support puppy mills and keeps them running.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Ann Olson, followed by Darren McBreath. Macbeth.
Hello.
Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Yes. Hello, Chair and committee members. My name is Ann Olson, and I'm the Executive Director of Animal Folks. We are based in Minnesota and deal with animal protection issues. We also do considerable research on puppy mills and the link to pet stores. We strongly support House File 3369. This issue, we believe, deals with mass production and selling of dogs and cats, which not only includes the puppies and kittens sold in the store, but also the adult breeding dogs in the kennel, who can suffer physical, but also the mental harm, such as severe fears, phobias, repetitive behavior. This is from being confined for years and bred repeatedly and then disposed of. No longer of use. Minnesota has some of the largest breeding kennels in the nation. Two kennels in Minnesota have over 1,000 dogs and puppies each. These facilities, along with other facilities in Minnesota and the nation, mass produce the puppies and kittens, who then get flipped to brokers or shipped and sold directly to pet stores where the animal will sit in a cage waiting to be bought. Pet stores who sell these animals are the face of the puppy and kitten mills. Consumers visit a pet store, see a cute kitten or puppy, and buy. But many are uninformed. They may not know where the puppy comes from or the condition of the breeding animals or facilities. We, our organization, have spoken with numerous consumers who have purchased sickly puppies from pet stores, ended up having to pay high vet bills to try and treat the animal. We literally have people calling us crying on the phone because they've just introduced their new pet to their family and their kids, and the pet dies, and they don't know what to do. Many pet stores, we have found, also misrepresent the product. The puppies and kittens are the living product. We testified recently at a Roseville City Council meeting about this issue. A pet store owner in the city claimed he only bought from small family breeders. We hear this a lot from different pet stores. We provided documents to the council showing that he actually purchased from a Minnesota breeder in southern Minnesota with over 900 dogs and puppies, and also from 4 breeders in Iowa, one of whom had 550 dogs and puppies. Consumers hear this and they're frustrated and angry because they feel they've been deceived. Pet stores also will boast that these breeders are licensed, which is true. But standards under the Federal Animal Welfare Act are minimal, and enforcement actions are shockingly poor. In fact, the Office of Inspector General has conducted numerous audits of the USDA's enforcement actions. And because the USDA has done such a poor job, the OIG announced they will be doing yet another audit. There are many pet stores in Minnesota who already use the humane pet store model. We believe this bill, the Humane Pet Store Bill, fits Minnesota's values and the interests of this state. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Darren McBeath, followed by Kristen Smith. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Darren McBeath, representing the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association. We take offense to the term puppy mills, much like production agriculture takes offense to factory farming. Puppy breeders, pet breeders are all over Minnesota of different sizes. Ironically, this bill will eliminate existing consumer protections by encouraging the consumer to obtain dogs from unregulated sources that are not required to abide by Minnesota's puppy lemon law. Yes, Minnesota has a puppy lemon law. On its website, the Board of Animal Health provides a comprehensive guide to the licensing requirements of commercial pet breeders and animal shelters or kennels that sell dogs and cats to the public. The comparison shows that the standards are very much alike. The basics for breeders and shelters are about the same. USDA regulations also are similar. Both the Board of Animal Health and Department of Agriculture accept complaints alleging failure to comply with relevant standards. Commercial breeder standards of care are at Minnesota Statutes 347.59, and the rules under kennel shelter facilities are at 1721.0520. There's, though, two basic differences with the sets of rules and standards. Those are the pet's background, which I'll get into real quick, and the protection for consumers. Pet breeders produce purpose-bred dogs of a particular breed, in some instances of blend breeds. They select the parents of the puppies and kittens. The health of the parents and puppies is monitored according to veterinary protocols approved by the Board of Animal Health. And in many instances, breeders have the parents tested for physical soundness, genetic traits that affect the health as well as the appearance of the puppies. The animals obtained for sale by shelters and rescues come from random sources. Generally, the parents are unknown. The dog's health records are undocumented. Its eventual size, appearance, behavior traits are a matter of guesswork. And that's okay. They deserve a loving home just like the others, but it's a matter of choice. The other major difference is the consumer protection. Minnesota sellers of purpose-bred puppies, whether in pet stores or directly by breeders, licensed, non-licensed, must be in compliance with specific statutory requirements set forth with the puppy lemon law, again, statute 325F.79. These include source and ownership history of the pet, detailed health records, current veterinary examination, notice of the buyer's rights to a refund, reimbursement or replacement if the pet is found to have a health problem the breeder or seller did not disclose to the buyer. The statute's informally again referred to as the puppy lemon law. And how does this law apply to shelters and rescues that sell dogs? It doesn't. They're exempted from providing any background or health information or warranty of the pet's source or condition. In conclusion, House File 3369 inserts government where it isn't needed between willing sellers and willing buyers who already have to abide by health and care standards for puppies and cats, other pets. And to make matters worse, while prohibiting business transactions between dog breeders and customers, the bill replaces those dogs with only shelter dogs that don't come with the same consumer protections that we have in law currently. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Kristen Smith, followed by Paula Mueller. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kristen Smith. I own the last pet store in the Twin Cities. So all of these stories and everything that's being said today will affect me. Okay, it's very important for me to come in here and tell you my story. We've been in business in the same location for 48 years. We're 2 years shy of our 50th anniversary. We're very proud of what we do. We love our puppies. We do a good job. We answer to our customers. We answer to our community. And we answer to the puppies. And there's nothing more important than what we do. I'm up here to tell you that I think that this bill is flawed. And I think it's based on some misinformation. What it appears is that they took the lemon law, which is what we use every day with every puppy, they took the middle of it out and replaced it with something saying we can't have our puppies, we can't own our puppies, we have no ownership or responsibility for the animals that are brought into the store. But it didn't change the end. It still put the responsibility of the exams, of the registration papers, of the paperwork, all that is still on the store. It's not listed separate. It's not saying that the rescues are going to cover those expenses, nor are they going to in any way reimburse the store for what we would have to put into it. It would be kind of donated on our part, maybe. I don't know. The other option is that the rescues potentially would be covered by the same lemon laws that we currently use. I don't know. It doesn't say. It's not clear. I don't know what they're trying to get at. We use that lemon law every single day. And to see it so changed without being done properly, that's not right. That's not right. The other thing I wanted to bring up, we were here back in 2014, and that was to kill the puppy mill. We put in place the breeder bill, we put in place standards for the breeders, inspectors, and there isn't anybody here that's an inspector that's even been inside one of the kennels that we work with. We don't work with the big guys, we work with the little ones. And it's important for us to make clear that the same way the pet industry used to be painted with a broad brush, now the rescue industry is being painted with a broad brush. And not everything fits. I think that this is, it's poorly written, and it's not going to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for allowing me.
Next up, we have Paula Mueller. And then if Steve Olson came back in the room, you still have a place on the agenda. Welcome to the committee, and you can state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Paula Mueller, and I have been the general manager of Northtown Mall in Blaine for the past 20 years. It has been my privilege to not only be the landlord for family-owned pet shop Four Paws and a Tail, but to be a customer and friend to owner Kristen Smith. I can say unequivocally that Ms. Smith is the most experienced animal and family advocate that I have ever met, and she has never associated with puppy mills, which is a term that has been thrown around quite a bit in this conversation today. As a citizen of the great state of Minnesota, a dog and cat mom, and one half of a nationally registered dog therapy team, I hope that the impetus of introducing this bill came from the heart. However, it strikes me as a bit heartless to target with this bill the only pet store in the Twin Cities that offers personal care and both animal and consumer protection. As a customer of both Four Paws and a Tail and the Animal Humane Society, I see no reason to single out Four Paws and a Tail. On my purchase receipts for both retail sites, I paid to adopt my animals and was charged sales tax in each instance. Yet only Four Paws and a Tail offered additional post-sale consumer protection. In closing, I wish to convey the importance of Four Paws and a Tail in our community center and in the greater community at large. I know just as our love for our pets is immeasurable, that the positive impact of Chris Smith and Four Paws and a Tail existing side by side with the Animal Humane Society and individual rescues is just as immeasurable. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to speak for or against this bill? Okay, you can line up and you will have, I see you right here, and then you'll have 3 minutes as well. And then once you testify, you'll sign in with the page. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Hi, thank you. My name is Megan Helling, and I was a unwitting, as well as my husband, consumer of a pet store dog. And I'm here to tell my story. I'm here for Monty, who was my heart. In January 2004, we bought a yellow Labrador puppy. From Northtown Mall, at the time it was called Pet Ranch. According to the Secretary of State, they changed their name in 2007 or 8, I believe, to Four Paws. Now this dog that we got, we were super excited to start our family, was a beautiful yellow Labrador puppy. Very soon he started having seizures before 6 months old, and we took him to the vet, of course, worked through that. Again, under a year of age, he couldn't take a walk for 3 blocks because his joints were so bad. So throughout his life, he had full hip replacement. He had full knee replacement. He was on non-steroidal anti-inflammatory since the age of 4. We had him on pain medicines to give him a quality of life by the age of 6. He lived to be the age of 13 because my husband and I were blessed to be able to afford to do so. But over the course of his life, we spent over $20,000. And I would do it again today because we love this animal so much. And what makes me crazy is when people talk about consumer protections, Monty wasn't a defective printer. Monty was a part of our family, and he was a living, human, sentient being. And so it just, to me, you can't put the two in the same sentence. So I really ask you, I implore you to support this, again, to protect unwitting consumers like myself. I certainly have spent time trying to educate those around me that puppy mills are real. And not only that Monty's life, quality of life was harder than it should have been, but I can't even imagine what his mother went through at the puppy mill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I see there was somebody else over here. And if anybody else wants to line up to testify, you can check in with the page. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Chairman, Dave Gary Uprood, and we own 4 dogs over the last 40 years of our life. And 3 of them came from pet stores, and 1 came from a personal friend of ours. The 3 from the pet stores have been absolute blessings to me and my family, and we've loved them. Ma'am, never had a problem. Never had any problems with any of our dogs we bought from the pet stores. I am in the pet industry, so I do listen to pet stores. I've got a business I've had for about 12 years now, but I've been in the industry for over 40 years. So I do hear from pet stores. I have seen a change in the pet industry over the last 40 years. We now have probably less than 5 or 6 pet stores that I actually do business with that actually sell puppies still. Only 1 here in the state of Minnesota, and she doesn't do fish anymore. So realistically, we don't even do business with Northtown anymore. But I love her store, and I've loved everything she's ever done with her store. I think it's a shame to think that we got to take away from the public another opportunity for them to purchase dogs, because we sold shelties ourselves, so I know what it's like to have people come to your home. And a lot of people don't want to come to homes. They want to go to a place they can go and look at dogs. They want to go to a place and have an opportunity to make that choice. And I think by taking away the pet store opportunity to sell dogs is going to take away from the public opportunity to buy dogs from their choice. And they're protected. Our state has put in place that puppy lemon law to protect the public. And yes, once in a while something slips through, like the lady just started here a little bit ago. But I can tell you, buying a dog from a humane society doesn't guarantee no problems either. We have seen problems with humane society puppies. And actually, there's probably even more problems because you get buying somebody else's problem. That's why they're at a humane society. I love the fact that people love to buy dogs from humane societies, and we're glad they're there because we have a need for them. But the humane societies today are starting to bring dogs in from other states. We're bringing dogs in from other countries. And with what's going on in this country right now with this virus, we ought to start looking at our humane societies and where they're bringing their dogs. We got to start looking at that, folks. We can't just ignore that fact. And we're concentrating on pet stores and where they're buying dogs from, but maybe we need to start taking a look at where the humane societies are buying or getting their dogs from and watch that, because I think that'll be a very big thing coming up here in the next few years. So, and that's all I got.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yep.
Well done on the 3 minutes. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
If I can get up on this chair. Hi, I'm short and I'm hard of hearing, so.
Just lean forward into the microphone, then we'll be able to hear you well.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name is Nona Dietrich. I am a dog breeder. I belong to, I have AKC dogs. I belong to Havanese Club of America, the Russian Toy Club of America, the North Star Havanese Club, the North Star Russian Toy Club. So you can see I'm actively involved. Besides, I'm a member of the Lake Minnetonka Kennel Club and Minnesota Purebred Dog Breeders Association. I only have 2 things, or maybe 3, I want to say. First thing, the last gentleman said, there are 100,000 dogs per year brought in from other countries to supply our humane societies for rescues. Well, not necessarily humane societies, but rescue organizations, including humane society, to keep the little cells full of puppies that they want to buy. Second, I want to say that in 2014, there was a bill that you passed here wherever you pass it here in Minnesota. It was House Bill, or the bill was 347.57. And in that bill, you may remember, hopefully some of you do, Barb Bartholomew talked a few times in this type of setting. Almost everything is covered for making people be responsible breeders and all of that. It would be so much easier than spending all of this time on a separate bill to put an addendum on the bill you already have in place. And secondly, this particular House File 3369 does not exempt the good, reputable breeders who want to provide for people and the puppies and for their lives. So it's very scary for us as good breeders. I have 1 minute left. Mm-hmm. To think that this bill would pass and in some way, in some future, that we would be called a pet stop, a pet shop, and then we couldn't be selling dogs either, because that can't happen. Because the wording in this document is not as clear as it should be. And that's all I need to say.
Thank you. Coming in under time. I think that is everybody who wanted to say something from the public, so we can turn to member discussion questions. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a kind of a general question. You know, a lot of terms were thrown out during the testimony talking about massive amounts of animals. You know, is there numbers that, you know, that you say would be a, I mean, what does that mean? Does that mean you have 5 or 6 breeding pairs? Does it mean you have 100 breeding pair that makes you big? You know, I'm a cattleman back home, so what are we talking about? You know, there's a lot of kind of this, a massive amount of puppies being produced. What do we have any direction there on what these testifiers are talking about? Is there numbers that we could come forward at all? And then also, you know, how many pet stores are we dealing with? I believe it's 10. And then what is the percentage of dogs that are sold? You know, obviously internet sales and whatnot, we're really going after brick and mortar institutions here, folks that are already following laws and have rules and inspections. Like, my guess is you're probably dealing with a very small percentage of potential dogs that have questionable backgrounds. I mean, what are we dealing with percentages here? What are we actually going to accomplish by this as far as percentages of animals sold?
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. It looks like Ms. Coughlin is back, and if you heard the questions and can respond to them, thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. And I think I heard two questions, and if I forgot one, please remind me. There is a definition of puppy mills that has come out through numbers of court cases, and that definition is they are commercial breeding facilities that disregard the health and welfare of animals to maximize profit. And so what is important to remember is that pet stores in Minnesota can source from puppy mills anywhere in the country. So when we look at this issue, what's really sort of central to the issue is what the federal standards are. And when we look at what the federal standards are, those federal standards will allow an animal, a breeding dog, to be kept in a wire crate stacked one on top of each other with only 6 inches around her body for her entire life, never stepping foot on grass, never stepping outside and feeling the sun on her back. That's perfectly legal under the federal standards. So that's really the standard that is applicable in this particular case. You spoke before also or were asking about the sort of number of dogs here. And again, looking at how the market has really already responded to this consumer concern and this consumer concern about puppy mills in general and this low federal standards, the market has largely shifted and responded to that already. In quite a profound way. In Minnesota, almost 140 stores that do pet stores that do not sell dogs and cats, fewer 10 than 10 that are left that continue to sell dogs and cats. According to the pet industry, only 4% of pets are obtained through pet stores. So there's clearly a good amount of animals available through responsible breeders, through rescues, and through humane societies.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski, follow up.
Thank you. So just 4% are animals. So the, in the 10 stores that exist that you're looking to go after in the state, only they're only responsible for selling 4% of the dogs or cats in the state of Minnesota.
It's potentially less.
To the chair and representative.
It's potentially less because that 4% is a national statistic. And so Minnesota has so few pet stores remaining that continue to sell dogs and cats that it could be less. And I think what's also very important to remember this isn't necessarily going after trying to put somebody out of business. As we heard before from Angel, pet stores can transition to a humane model, and many have, and many do. My organization has a program that we actually offer free of charge to pet stores to help them transition to a humane model where they can start to work with shelters and rescues if they choose to. So looking at the market, having already created and evolved this viable, financially successful alternative, that's completely possible.
Follow up, Representative Swazinski.
Madam Chair, I just probably just more of a collective comment. You know, it's interesting that it seems like this is more of a dog and pony show when it comes to a bill. You know, when you look at this organization that's pushing this, this has been very detrimental to animal agriculture across our state, throughout the Midwest, going after hog producers, cattlemen, chicken, the rest. And this is the soft, fuzzy face of this organization's going after not only animal culture across our country. And you know, folks, I would caution you on this particular issue, especially when you're dealing with such a small portion of animals. 4% potentially or less, as the testifier said, of the animals stated and sold across our state that are through these 10 potential outlets, especially when we have good breeders. You know, I asked the question, can you source from, we have, you know, this 2014 law that was passed. You know, if these folks are willing to source from those particular folks, you know, this puts them out of business as well. And I don't think that's right.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. Additional questions, members? Comments? Seeing none.
Pardon?
Who has a question? You wanted to answer Representative Swazinski's question?
Yes, I would like.
Okay. Typically, we have the author's presenter close up and answer the questions, but if Representative Swazinski would like you to answer your question and he wants to call you down, you can do that. You may come down and answer your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity.
Can you state your name?
My name is Kristen Smith.
Thank you.
We were talking about Minnesota numbers rather than national numbers. Minnesota has two pet stores that sell puppies. It's me and one down in Faribault that only offers 6 to 8 puppies in their store at any given time. We are working trying to make sure that the customers that we deal with, we hear the same sad stories. Customers that come in that have a rescue that they aren't happy with and no recourse. There's no warranty, there's no information where the animals came from. And the only thing that they can do is take the dog back. With the lemon law, we offer protection, financial protection, and that doesn't happen with the rescues. I understand that it's a different entity, but it still causes an awful lot of heartbreak to families.
Thank you for your answer. I have a question for Dr. Roberts or Dr. Brayshaw, or both of them, if they want to come down. Thank you, Dr. Brayshaw. And my question for you is, has the puppy lemon law solved the problem that we were seeing? Minnesota is, we've had some pretty big news stories about some puppy mills that have been shut down in the state. I think the conditions are that we've seen have been pretty horrifying. And there was a famous one in 2015. Has that ended the problem of puppy mill produced dogs finding their way into the market?
I have not seen the lemon law handle the problem, because the problem is not after adoption or after the animal is purchased, but it is really upstream from that. It's where those animals are bred or where they are produced on the front end that we see the issues. And that's where when we do see cruelty cases dealing with the ones we did in 2015 that we saw these problems.
Thank you. And with regard to this bill, are we putting reputable breeders at risk? I'm a rescue mom in far too many times as far as my husband is concerned. But if I wanted to go and find myself a beagle or a doodle of some type, or would that be difficult for me as a consumer to find a reputable breeder?
No, because the and I do not know exact numbers for percentages of reputable breeders that may sell to a pet store, but if you do want a breed of any sort, you can go get it through a breeder. On the personal side of it, my mother-in-law loves party poodles, and very easily was find they're adorable poodles that are kind of cow color, but was able to go find some very easily, and there are a plethora of very good breeders in the state of Minnesota that are able to meet the desired breed-specific needs.
Thank you for that clarification. Any other questions for members?
Nope.
Seeing no further questions, your last word, Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate everyone's comments today. I think that overall this bill is set up to end the sale of retail cats and dogs in the state of Minnesota. To me, I think, you know, it's a double-edged sword when we say, oh, it's going to only impact so few dogs, it's not worth putting into law. But then at the same time, we're saying, oh, this is a huge detrimental impact to two or six or maybe 10 retail establishments in the state of Minnesota. When we're seeing that stores continue to have great success selling accessories, selling food, selling consumable products to families to support their pets. So those are ongoing sales. When you're building that relationship, yes, somebody might come back to you to buy another pet, hopefully 10, 15 years down the road, depending on how long the animal is alive. But it's certainly not something that you can really build your business model on when somebody's going to come back month after month after month to buy food or to buy a fancy collar or to buy toys and treats and all of those sorts of things. So I think that when we look at the state of animal welfare, I think that this bill is a step in the right direction, and we can continue to have conversations. I hope for everyone's support for this bill. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Watun. Hearing no further discussion, Representative Katiza Watun refers her motion that House File 3369 be re-referred to Judiciary and Finance Civil Law Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
The motion prevails. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Katiza Watun. Next up, I get to present a bill.
All right. The next item on the agenda is an informational hearing on House File 2234. Since this is an informational hearing, we don't need a motion from you, Chair Halverson, so I'll just turn the floor over to you to discuss the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 2234 is a bill that was brought to me last year to work out some hiccups that we're seeing in between auto repair and insurance. We want the experience to be seamless. We also know that technology is changing rapidly with regard to what it takes to repair a car. And we want to be sure that our laws are current and up to date and represent the best way for these two entities to work together. I'm very grateful to all the parties, both the insurers and the auto repair CHOPS, who have been working very hard to come to some agreement. I think these parties have come close, and they've come close enough that I think it's worthwhile for the committee to get to hear about issues that these parties are coming together to try to solve. So with that, I can turn it over to testimony.
And the first testifier on the list is Aaron Cocking of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. That's not who we have.
No.
Maybe the first testifier can just identify himself for the record. And
I can do that. Thank you. Wow. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Daryl Amberson. I'm the president of operations for Lemaitre's Collision. We have about a dozen locations in the Twin Cities performing auto repair. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Alliance of Automotive Service Association for Providers of Minnesota. I also serve on some boards and committees on various other associations and education entities. I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide some perspective regarding the legislation that we've worked on for the last year or so. House File 2234 is a bill that we worked on last year in an effort to ensure payment for collision repairs, which followed repair guidelines of original equipment manufacturers. We work closely with the insurance industry to find common ground on this issue. The 2019 session came close without finding peace in the valley, which also is frequently referred to in the Commerce Committee. However, we did spend much of the summer and fall in negotiations with the insurance industry and nearly came to a compromise just a couple of months before the 2020 legislative session. We do not intend to analyze the legislation that was introduced last year or the changes which we were considering during the interim. Rather, we want to simply provide a bit of context so that you will understand what's at stake as we continue our dialogue with the insurance industry on repair procedures. And it should be noted that we have excluded parts requirements as part of this. A little background on this. When I started in the industry, we were a generic repair industry. I was taught how to heat, shrink, weld, pull, do various procedures such as that in the repair of a collision, vehicle damaged by a collision. Fast forward to today's world, that's ancient history. Today, vehicles are so complex that we are instructed to on virtually every repair to look up factory repair procedures and repair them specifically as the manufacturer tells us to. CAFE standards have definitely affected how vehicles are constructed a lot. We're dealing with more types of materials, ultra-high strength steels, magnesium, aluminum, things like that. A lot of different types of fastening methodology that we deal with in terms of adhesives, different forms of welding, brazing, and other methodologies. Electronics have become such a huge part of our industry. It's staggering right now. Of the top, I believe, top 20 high-tech companies in our country, many of them are automobile manufacturers. Some mainstream vehicles, such as Chrysler Pacifica, can have over 200 control modules in it. Some of our vehicles have more lines of computer code in them than current fighter jets or Boeing 737. It is our job as collision repairers to make the vehicle crash-worthy, again, preparing it for its next crash, and so that it behaves exactly the same way as it would have when that vehicle manufacturer had it crash-tested. That is our mission. And unfortunately, let's go back here. There is a high-profile case that brought a lot of attention to this not long ago. There is a case in Texas. A repair was performed by Giant Eagle Collision, replaced a roof on a Honda Fit. A young couple driving that vehicle later involved in a significant accident, structural damage to the car, resulting fire, life-threatening injuries that will they survived, but were forever changed in their lives. And a jury awarded them a settlement of $42 million and had the collision repair shop fund $32 million of that. The reason being that they had not put the roof on with the methodology as prescribed by Honda, and it was determined that the car was not did not sustain the damage in the way it was designed, and therefore they attributed that responsibility to the collision repair shop. That by itself, and there have been other cases, most are not so well publicized, scares the living daylights out of us as collision repairers. So what we really want to do is fix cars properly and be able to sleep at night. That, when I say we, I'm talking about those repairers that are most inclined to want to perform high-quality repairs. So it is our mission to fix cars as the manufacturers tell us to. And I'm afraid for those who want to alter that, one becomes a bit of an amateur engineer in terms of assuming how the car is going to behave later in another collision, and that's what we're trying to avoid. Unfortunately, some of my friends on the insurance side don't always want to pay for these methodologies. Sometimes, to be frank, they're a little stuck in the past, and they want to use some old methodologies or different methodologies to reduce cost. I know when they talk to you today, they're going to talk about increased costs of repairs, and yes, repairs do cost more than they used to. I think severity right now is probably somewhere between $3,500 and $4,000. A typical collision repair 5 or 10 years ago probably was around $2,500. But at the same time, we are already seeing a reduction in the frequency of accidents. There are not quite as many accidents happening. And also, we've seen some reduction in the number of personal injuries. We see a parallel in the aircraft industry with our industry because they have embraced safety far more so in the past than we have. And as a result of using new technologies, created a much safer methodology of transporting people. And I believe we as an auto repair industry are going down the same path. All one has to do is turn on the television. You can see many vehicle manufacturer ads emphasize safety. And people pay a lot of attention right now to crash test ratings on vehicles. So as a result, because we unfortunately can't always get the insurers to pay for the factory repair methodology, we are seeking a legislative solution for this to assist us in this matter. And so the bill that we were talking about would only say that it would be illegal for an insurer to not pay for the factory repair methodology when we're fixing a car that way. It doesn't say that if you brought me your 20-year-old car and you wanted to put a less expensive fender on it, do something like that, that I would have, I couldn't do that. No, it's not saying that. But what we're primarily concerned about is as we're fixing newer cars, we want to do it the proper way. We want to know that the car is going to behave as it was designed in its next collision.
Thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. And you will notice that we switched authors. I was just the stunt author while Representative Richardson, who's the chief author, was presenting another bill in another committee. So welcome back. And thank you for your testimony. We did start going out of order. So next up, we can have Aaron Conking from the Insurance Federation of Minnesota give us an update.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Aaron Conking. I'm the Executive Vice President for the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Following a crash, consumers and insurers have the same goal, a safe, professional, high-quality repair at a fair price. We believe that insurers and repair facilities should work together to achieve these goals. This bill attempts to remove insurers from the discussion and instead make them pay the choice of auto repairers and manufacturers. In fact, this bill does not provide any mechanism for an insurer to legitimately object to unnecessary repairs demanded by the repair shops or dispute the costs associated with the repair. While the availability of technical repair guidance from vehicle manufacturers to repair facilities and insurers is important, what is currently available is so varied that such a requirement will provide less clarity for consumers, insurers, and repair facilities. This bill also raises questions regarding the constitutionality of legislation that delegates authority to a third party or references such guidance as standards that are not established by a recognized standard-setting process or organization. As such, we must oppose legislation that would create a statutory requirement that would require an insurer to pay for repairs based on recommendations of the vehicle manufacturer. While the bill requires body shops to complete repairs using specifications, procedures, and other documentation from manufacturers, the language could allow body shops to complete unnecessarily expensive repairs based on any general document from the manufacturers. The manufacturer should provide definitions that distinguish technical repair standards from mere recommendations. Manufacturer position statements, technical service bulletins, and other general guidance should be considered on a case-by-case basis after evaluating specific facts, vehicle equipment, and amount of damages with respect to each loss. We also believe the bill should require that the repair facility provide documentation of the standard the facility used so insurers can make certain the facility is not billing for work not performed. Our industry also does not understand why insurance-funded repairs are treated differently in this bill than repairs being paid for by a consumer. any manufacturer's repair specifications should apply to the repair and the repair facility, not just the insurer's payment. As they talked about earlier, this bill will lead to higher repair costs and, by extension, higher insurance rates. And that's concerning to us. And we're not the only people concerned about the cost of these repairs. I believe included in your packet is a letter that Congressman Bobby Rush from Illinois sent to the Federal Trade Commission. And he writes, repair costs have risen 14% in the last year, outpacing inflation in each of the last 15 months. He goes on to write that the FTC should investigate the extent to which this cost increase is due to anti-competitive practices within the auto manufacturing, parts, and repair markets, and what additional steps, if any, are needed to restore competition and therefore reduce the cost to consumers. You heard earlier, we've been told by the proponents of this legislation that insurers should just pay the higher costs associated with this bill and pass them on to our policyholders in the form of higher premium. And if this bill were to pass, that is exactly what would happen. But for the sake of Minnesota policyholders, it shouldn't. Vehicles, as Mr. Amberson testified to, are getting more expensive to repair, and he listed the several factors that are leading to that. This bill will add to those costs without a corresponding benefit to the consumer. We've continued to meet with AASP to negotiate a deal. As you can see from the testimony today, we're still a ways apart. I do want to briefly talk about, and I wasn't going to talk about today, but Mr. Amberson brought up the Texas case, and I want to reiterate trial testimony from the John Eagle repair shop itself suggested that they made the decision. It wasn't the insurance company telling them that they had to do it. The one of the repair guys was on the stand saying in an aggressive fashion that bonding, that gluing was better than welding, that gluing was better than welding. And so to the extent that the Honda repair specifications in that case were to actually perform a weld, the repair shop itself had gone away from those standards. And so for those reasons, those are the issues we have with the bill. Happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking. If you could just stick around.
Sure.
And next we'll hear from Kevin Fisk and Patrick Garrity. And I'll ask you to be succinct with your testimony so that we have a couple minutes for members to ask questions. We will have a hard stop at 4 p.m. And we have 8 minutes. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kevin Fisk. I'm with LKQ Corporation. We're the world's largest supplier and distributor of aftermarket, recycled, and remanufactured auto parts, materials, and services to the auto repair industry. We have 12 facilities throughout Minnesota with over 380 employees. From our perspective, this bill potentially will stifle healthy competition in the auto repair market. It could easily allow the original equipment manufacturers of automobiles to create barriers to service and repairs to their vehicles. And why I say that, specifically the language citing OEM repair procedures and specifications is ambiguous. It's not been defined in this bill, and that would allow the auto manufacturers to draft procedures that would be potentially very detrimental to their competition in parts and services. We support the repair shops, the body shops, receiving just compensation for the repairs they've done on these vehicles. But this measure does not address the definition or outline the allowable scope of what repair procedures and specifications mean. So how are we to interpret that? It causes us to question what would they be allowed to do? Would they be allowed to specifically say what tools and materials could be used in the repair? Whose tools could be used in the repair? Would it allow the manufacturer to stipulate that only authorized or certified providers that they have a special relationship with to perform these certain procedures? Now, my company has an interest, aside from parts, which we know has been carved out, Aside from parts, we provide service as well. And let me state for you, with the advanced driver assistance systems that assist the driver either in driving or parking, after a crash, those repair shops will perform a scan to see what is malfunctioned as a result of that crash. Once that scan tells them what systems are faulty, what needs to be repaired, they make the repair. But following the repair, they need to calibrate those systems to make sure those cameras, those sensors, those safety options that are now becoming standard to the vehicles work. There are so many different testing devices and models for each and every make of a vehicle on the road today. They're not all the same, and not all repair shops could be expected to have the dozens that are required. It's a service that we provide, and of course, we are concerned perhaps that if we're not identified as a preferred or a certified or an authorized provider of service, as might be our competition, that is something that could go into those specifications or procedures. So that is just one facet. I think that that is language that needs to be cleared up. It's a significant hurdle. Potentially, it's a slippery slope to including parts at some later point. But for now, those are our concerns, and that's the cause of our opposition today.
Thank you. Welcome to the, you can switch spots there. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed, and we have less than 5 minutes in our committee hearing.
I'll be succinct.
I know you will be. Thank you.
My name is Patrick Garrity. I own Sharp Auto Parts in Stillwater, Minnesota. I have 25 employees. I'm also the current president of the Automotive Recyclers of Minnesota Association. And I'm here today on behalf of my company and the automotive recycling industry to oppose this legislation. Our concerns are that by driving up the cost of repairing automobiles, more and more vehicles will be written off as total losses. Requiring only OEM procedures will have the following consequences. It will tremendously increase the cost of repairs and insurance rates, and it will hurt the survivability of independent auto body repair shops by artificially requiring specialized procedures and equipment, which is not available to the independent shops. While today's cars and trucks have become increasingly complex, the underlying challenge is not necessarily technical in nature. Rather, automakers, through mystification and often via monopolistic business practices, create barriers to servicing and repairing their own products. We are not opposed to body shop performing proper repairs and receiving just compensation, but this proposal gives too much power to the OEMs in defining the recommended repair procedures.
Thank you for your testimony, and I see Representative Davids has a comment question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank you for your wisdom on not having a vote on this bill. This bill, I mean, that there's no peace in the valley in this. I mean, this is one where you got friends on both sides, but this bill is written so one-sided, it's so extreme. I don't think I've seen one so extreme as this. That it's going to raise everybody's insurance rates. It has more fencing. It has more fencing. There's so much fencing in this bill, you could build the wall with this bill quite easily. So I hope to never see this bill again in the rest of my life. It's so bad, and I don't know if the industry and my friends at the body shops can come together on something here, but we're a long ways apart on this. This bill is so extreme. This bill is so unfair. Now, my mother, God rest her soul, never told me life would be fair, but this is really bad. I've seen a lot of bad bills. I've carried a lot of bad bills, but this is in my top 10 in 28 years. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your wisdom on this.
Thank you, Representative Davids. And we wanted to allow folks on both sides to have their say on this bill, but you're absolutely right. It's not
quite there, and we need these organizations to come together and work together. And I have heard a willingness. Frankly, I've heard more of a willingness for people to work together than I heard at committee today. So I hope that the parties continue to work together, and that willingness that I've heard in my office is demonstrated. Representative Richardson, you get the final word, and we're going to adjourn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this is about consumer protection and about consumer safety, which everyone has agreed is definitely a goal. And Representative Davids, I know that you've got some concerns about the bill, and we're continuing to work through with those. And so hopefully you'll also sign on to the new bill as well as we continue to work towards things. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Seeing no further business in front of us today, we are adjourned. Have a great evening.